Military Veterans Affairs of Order. It is 1:02 p.m. on Thursday, April 13th. We're in the Gruenberg Room here in Juneau, the capital. With me, I have Representative Shaw, Representative Groh, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Wright. Let the record reflect, we do have a quorum to conduct business. Please mute all cell phones and silence them. First off, I'd like to thank Talia Eames with the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting. Also a veteran.
There you go.
Thank you. Also Kevin Allen with House Records for documenting today's meeting. We have two presentations on the agenda today. First, we will be viewing an overview of the Alaska Naval Militia by Captain Jason Woodard. Mr. Woodard, would you please begin?
Absolutely. Thank you, committee, for having us today. For the record, it's Captain Jason Woodward, retired from the Navy last year and then took over the commander officer position for the Naval Militia. Little background on Naval Militia. It has been around the state of Alaska since 1974. It did get unestablished and reestablished in 1985. There's some statute slides on what gives us the authority. Roll through those. Here's the current organization. We're about 48 members strong. We did kind of go through a period in the last 2 years where the numbers started to drop. They're starting to come back up again now, and that really is directly reflective of the way the current TAG is managing the unit. When one thing that changed recently on this slide is very much similar to the state of New York militia. We're allowing for a 5% retired members status now, which is where I fall in. That's done for leadership continuity. So within our numbers, we have 5% of us that are actually in a retired status from the federal side that is managing the leadership side for what our unit is constructed of. Our unit is all of the Navy reservists are eligible that live in the state of Alaska, and they drill and work from a Title 10 perspective on J-Bear. There's about 100 of us, and about 50 currently are registered with the Naval Militia. What that means is on my uniform, you can see I'm wearing Alaska. These are Navy Type 3s. We are in a Title 10 status unless you guys call on us or the governor does. We move into a Title 32 status on state active duty. We take off our Navy and we put on Alaska. We take off our U.S. flag and we put on our state of Alaska flag. And then we respond to the need appropriately at that point. In the state, we have at the officer level, we have had limited participation. It's starting to come back now. And those are more highly skilled, like pilots, a couple FedEx pilots, military shipboard stuff, guys like that. Myself, I was a helicopter pilot. We tend to integrate with the staff better at a joint staff level if that ever came in. But we're not typically recalled for mission sets in the state of Alaska. We have a lot on the enlisted side. Typically, our recalls are E5 and below. And a lot of them are MA, medical, but oftentimes just bodies for natural disasters. Mutual benefit for us, we're very inexpensive. We don't cost anything unless you ask for us to help. When you ask for us to help, it is at the discretion of our Title 10 command. So if our command needs us, we can't come. Typically, we can, though, and we'll respond. I typically get a request from the joint staff. It usually comes in via text, honestly. Then I'll shortly thereafter get a frag order, which I'll push out to the unit. Usually we're moving by that point. The benefits to us, which is a huge benefit to a lot of our younger Alaska enlisted members, is the education side. They align with the Guard for education benefits. So when education is funded, they're very active in using those benefits to be on that recall list for state disasters. Here's a list of the stuff that we have responded to. Recent years, we've been very active. We responded alongside the State Defense Force for COVID-19 support. We responded with 5 members for Typhoon Murbach. That was actually a really great exercise for us because we had several young Navy enlisted members that actually got to go for the first time and travel on a C-130 or an H-60 to get into that environment. And they're doing that on state active duty orders in a Title 32 status, wearing this uniform. We also responded to the Seward landslide. We were road guards there, and then we sent several guys down to shovel snow in the Yakutat snowstorm. Any questions for me?
Representative Rauscher?
All right. Through the chair, I'm going to show my ignorance. But so I see the wings on your pocket there. But what is on your right shoulder? I can't see anything. I just thought I'd ask.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, this is a State of Alaska flag and subdued. So it's actually the flag, but on this uniform we wear it subdued, not the blue background.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the answer.
Yes.
I'm good. Thank you.
Representative Shaw?
Through the chair, can you give me a comparison between you and the Alaska Defense Force?
Through the chair, sir, we are aligned with them on the org structure underneath TAG as the organized militia. That's about the extent of our comparison. Our expectation and the TAG's expectation, too, is we are a working unit that is not directly assigned to the state. So we like to go train alongside the Guard when we can. Sometimes that's limited based on what our requirements are on the Title 10 side. And there's also this kind of gray area where we operate under joint training. And the legal side of the state and the legal side of the Fed have allowed us to do that in this uniform. And it's training status. So we don't typically have a lot of unit-specific training until we're recalled. And when we're recalled, we align. And the TAG knows they're getting members that are federally ADCON, we would call it. So they're physically qualified. They're medically ready to go. They're passing the physical standards to go out and work alongside a military unit. That's the big difference. They don't have the same standards on the State Defense Force.
Understood. Thank you.
Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair, can we go to the mutual benefit slide? Yeah, that one. So can you please explain the pension benefit and how that works?
Absolutely. Through the chair. So when we are aligned, we get what's called a good year in the Navy. Every time we meet all of our standards, we get a good year, and that's identified as a one in our retirement qual on the Fed side. As long as we do that, we're also earning a concurrent benefit with the state. But that benefit is not realized until we retire from federal support, so 20 years, and we have 5 years of continued service in the Naval Militia. Once that happens, then that benefit of $100 each month, is a lump sum benefit. So if I did 20 years in the Naval Militia, 20 times 12 times 100 would be the benefit. And I don't have that at the top of my head, or I could help you out. Does that make sense? $20,000, roughly. And we have very few people that qualify for that because most of us are doing it for service or education, that kind of stuff. They don't typically make it in the state of Alaska 20 years.
Follow up. I guess I understand, like, the naval retirement.
Yeah.
But what does that – I mean, so are you the Naval Militia is giving additional money? If you continue to serve in the Naval Militia, you get additional money added to your retirement, your pension?
Yes, sir. So through the chair, I each year I'll submit a spreadsheet back to the Department of Veterans Affairs, Retirements and Benefits, And that spreadsheet is annually kept up.
So you can get a good year for militia service.
Correct. Yes.
Even if you didn't get paid for your militia service.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
We are paid to be, we are on a recall status to support the state when needed.
Right. But you can get a good year without getting recalled.
Correct.
Okay.
Our good years are aligned with federal good years.
And you would get an additional $100 per month. It says guard service, so that's not militia service.
How about I'll check it back to on this one?
Yeah, we can get you a better answer.
Okay.
Because I'm going to talk, we're going to go in circles for a while. Okay. I understand where you're going with it. It's, from my personal perspective, it's not enough of a benefit to do the job, but we're not asking for that either. We enjoy the service. We enjoy being called to action when we need it. And I usually don't have a problem finding people to fill the need when asked.
Through the chair, I'm not opposed to the benefit. I'm just wanting to find out exactly what the benefit is and how people qualify for it.
Understand.
Thank you.
And you also do training monthly, right, as well?
We do with our Navy units. So we actually in Alaska right now we have one actual unit in Alaska, so we're pretty underserved in our ability to support Title 10 assets. Most of our members are what we call cross-assigned out. So they're assigned to a unit that's outside of Alaska. That is their primary reporting UIC or function.
I'm so sorry. Can you repeat that? So most of your people are assigned to a unit outside of Alaska?
So every state, through the chair, so every state has a Naval Reserve Center. That reserve center is where the Naval Reservists hang their hat that are working for whatever their unit is within the federal side. Alaska's is on Jay Bear in Anchorage. We have about 100 people from most of them came from a prior command and then they retired. They went on the reserve side and they now live in Alaska and they're working for a unit towards their retirement with the federal side. Their units are not in Alaska, but they live in Alaska and they drill in Alaska. So they'll actually fly to their unit somewhere else when they're asked to.
Follow up. I'm sorry. And this is probably just semantics, and I apologize for not understanding. Is the Naval Militia also the Navy Reserves? Is the Alaska Navy? Okay, so because there's 100 in the reserves. Is this about the reserves or is this about the Naval Militia? How do those go together? Absolutely. I understood 48 in the Naval Militia, 100 in the reserves. How are those different and the same?
Absolutely. Through the chair, so we're Navy Reservists first, which is a Title 10 status. Mm-hmm. As a Navy Reservist in Title 10, statute allows us to volunteer to be assimilated into the Naval Militia. There's 6 states in the country that have that capability. Mm-hmm.
Follow up. So I understand it's different. The Alaska State Defense Force has folks who are no longer in the military. If I'm correct, then the Alaska Naval Militia are folks who are currently reservists who can additionally be part of the Naval Militia. But the Naval Militia, unlike the Alaska State Defense Force, is not for folks who are done with the military. This is for folks who are still in the military. Would yes. that be correct?
That is 100% correct.
And once you're done with the reserves, you're no longer in the Naval Militia? Or can you continue in the Alaska Naval Militia
Until this last year, we changed the statute to allow for 5% of us to be in a retired status, which that's where I fit. So I retired from this Navy last year, and now I'm running the militia in that 5% status.
I understand a lot more. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. I understand that, just so you understand, that he is in the National Guard as we speak right now, right? Is that correct? That's why he asked the questions.
Through the chair. That is correct. But for the record, I do not speak for the Department of Defense, for the U.S. military, for the National Guard, or for the Office of Veterans Affairs. Nothing I say has anything to do ever with the United States military. Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your service.
I do appreciate that. And Representative Grohl.
I'm just another legislator who doesn't speak for the Department of Defense here in this room. Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask more about the membership. As we've established, currently the Alaska Naval Militia has 48 members. Can you talk about trends in the last 10 or 20 years in membership? Is this a peak? Is this a bottom? It can't be a bottom because at one point you had only one or maybe zero. Mm-hmm. So could you describe the trend in membership over the years, sir, please?
Through the chair, I will do my best. Okay. I'll speak from a personal standpoint. How about that? So I joined the militia because when I was on a drill weekend, they came and they said, hey, we'd love to have you be in the militia. This is what it looks like. And I was like, okay, I can do that. That's typically your officer's engagement. We are there for a major disaster, and our Title 10 does not want us. We would love to help out, and we're much more connected to the state side at a military organizational level through the Naval Militia. So the previous, previous tag made a requirement where we were required to drill a certain number of our drills each year with the Guard. That was directly in conflict with our ability to perform our primary mission, and so our numbers started to drop off because we couldn't meet that requirement. There wasn't a tangible benefit for most of us, because we needed to be focused on our Title 10 job. The current tag removed that requirement and also put the 5% piece in place, which did 2 things for us. We have a very limited amount of senior officers that are even willing to do the job that I'm doing. And there was too much red tape on it, so we just didn't do it. Now that's not an issue. And so our numbers are trending up again. So I've seen them as high as 60 when I first joined the militia. I saw it drop into the 30s in the last few years, and now we're coming on, we're back on the rise. And we are more attractive to some of those senior officers that would now fill joint staff roles in a major disaster that needed more organization. Right now, most of our stuff is we send several of our junior enlisted to go support whatever that construct is.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Rouser.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I was just wondering, going back to the 5%, which you've hit on twice, how is that decided? How do you decide who is encompassed in the set of 5%?
Through the chair, sir, it's the TAG, I would say, decides it. So I had a sit-down interview with the TAG. We talked about it. That was when the statute changed. And now when I have someone that fits that requirement, which I have one guy right now who I've asked and he has allowed to bring in under that status. The reason I asked was he had 30 years of Naval Militia experience, and I really wanted to have that history. And he also is very engaged in the retirements and benefits side, which he's drawing retirement. So it just was a language I didn't speak, and we're now cleaning a lot of that up, and that was why. So the TAG, and they can come and go at the TAG's discretion.
Follow up.
So out of 100, that's 5 guys.
Correct, sir.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand. Thank you.
So, Captain Woodward, would you kind of talk about some of the operations you've helped with here in Alaska, the emergency disasters that you responded to, or in history in the last 5 years at least, the Naval Militia has responded to?
Yes, sir. So let me go back to that slide. I would say the biggest one was the Murbach recently, which everyone's very familiar with. The way that happened was I got a text from the Joint Staff. They had a requirement for 5 is what they wanted. I asked them for 24 hours, went out to the unit. We came back with 5 to include one senior enlisted because it was a large enough mobilization that we wanted to send some organizational structure with it as well. And then those 5 members went downrange within 24 hours on state active duty orders, which was organized by the office themselves, and supported that mission for about a week. That's a typical deployment. Yakutat was the exact same. COVID tracing was a little bit longer. We had members that were on state active duty orders for, I think, up to a month on that one, alongside state defense and guard units for that mission. Did I answer that question?
Yep. Cool. That's what I was asking for. We actually have one more question. Representative Rouser.
Yeah, thank you very much, through the chair. I was wondering, through the Swan Lake Fire, what would have been your duty on the Swan Lake Fire?
Through the chair, Swan Lake Fire was road guards. So we sent young enlisted members down there to be road guards.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. All right, so we also have another presentation. Mr. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Simmons. Do you mind putting yourself on the record in the beginning?
Pardon me for a second. Chair and Council, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Sammons. I'm the Emergency Services Officer for the Alaska Wing Civil Air Patrol. What is Civil Air Patrol? It is a federally chartered 501c3 nonprofit that also has the ability to be activated in a Title 10 status when federally deemed necessary. We serve as a civilian auxiliary to the United States Air Force, and we go in and out of auxiliary status depending on the needs of the Air Force at the time. And we've been established and operating for over 80 years. Core mission sets, emergency services, that's disaster relief, doing points of distribution support, sandbags, damage assessments, taking uploading photos to both FEMA and other GIS platforms, depending on the customers that we're serving, whether it's a state or a local entity. Most common one here in Alaska is going to be our search and rescue and our support of SAR missions throughout the state. This includes joint integration with the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center on Elmendorf, and then supporting large-scale search missions with the search and rescue assets, both federal and state. Counter-drug missions are not very common in the state due to our relaxed standards on the ERAD, marijuana eradication missions. The humanitarian services supporting our community. This is, again, some of the other points of distribution and sandbag and flood mitigation strategies. Our cadet program is a second of our three missions. And this is taking young adults from the ages of 12 all the way to their 21st birthday, introducing them to leadership skills and starting to meet certain standards of both educational expectations as well as physical fitness and character development, and introducing them to core strategies to make them better citizens. This is the Title 36 is our 501c3 status. It's a federally chartered corporation. It's a volunteer organization for the public welfare and interest. And then we have the Title 10 status, which is the Volunteer Civilian Auxiliary of the Air Force. That allows us to operate within the confines that the Air Force sets for us, but also allows us to do certain missions that other volunteer organizations are not able to participate in. And so we do have a two status. There's the Civil Air Patrol as the volunteer organization, and there's Civil Air Patrol as the actual auxiliary of the Air Force. More of the legal stuff. There is no permanent Air Force auxiliary. It's a temporary legal status that's mission defined for the purposes of the just last the length of whatever mission we're participating in. Organizational structure for the purposes of this meeting, the Alaska Wing sits at the bottom of that square, and that's the wing itself is a geographical confine, so it's the state of Alaska. I'm a member of the Alaska Wing, and then we have units spread out throughout the state in different communities, and those are our squadrons, and some units that don't meet the full size of a squadron are flights, and they report to a squadron, which is going to be a larger community that's able to support some of their administrative tasks. Organizational chart, looking at where we are placed throughout the communities of Alaska. The dot up at the northwestern section in Galena was a school that recently closed prior to COVID, but we had about 11 cadets and three senior members out of there in an aircraft. That program folded, and we reallocated the aircraft throughout the state. But Bethel, King Salmon, and Kodiak are going to be our westernmost units. And then our northernmost units will be in Fairbanks, Eielson, and Tokoe. The southeast, we have units in Juneau and a flight in Sitka and also a squadron down in Ketchikan down in the southeast. And then the Anchorage Kenai Peninsula is also represented there. Our aircraft resources are broken up as listed 21 aircraft. However, only 18 of those aircraft are powered. Three of them are gliders. We use that for primary flight instruction for cadets that are not eligible to enter into private pilot training. So at the age of 13, they can start working towards a glider rating, and they have to be 17 before they can solo on a powered aircraft. So that gives them about 3 years of training to work on their glider rating, and then they add that when they go into a powered syllabus. The other aircraft used to support our various missions are Gippsland GA-8 aircraft. We have four of those stationed throughout that wing. That allows us to do passenger movement, supply movement. It also serves as a command and control platform in the air for when we're supporting large-scale search and rescue operations. Similar with the Cessna 206, and then our 182s and 172s are both primary flight instruction, but also light, fast SAR aircraft that we can get into a search area and start doing searching, and then also with our camera capability doing imagery for damage assessment. And then the three Cessna 185s live a hybrid life between skis and floats to allow us more access to rural Alaska and the non-paved conditions that present them. For membership, updated numbers.
I do have a question for you, Representative Shaw.
Yeah, through the chair, does CAP own all your own aircraft? Are these privately owned aircraft that volunteer back to the CAP?
Through the chair, Representative Shaw, the aircraft are owned by Civil Air Patrol, the 501c3. These are not the member-furnished aircraft. And we've seen a decline in use of member-owned aircraft due to restrictions with, like, federal tort and claims when a member volunteers their private property for that. So it is something we try to encourage wherever possible, but it's something that's not as appealing as using a furnished aircraft.
Please continue. Oh, actually, we have another question. Representative Rosser.
Thank you. Through the chair, I see six airplanes here. So what's a typical flight crew consist of, since I see six different types of airplanes?
Through the chair, for primary missions, when we have what's is identified as a mission pilot, that's a private pilot with at least 200 hours of PIC, and then a crew complement is either going to be a secondary pilot or a dedicated air crew member, such as a mission observer, which I am myself a qualified mission observer, and then also a mission scanner who is occupying either the back seat or also fulfilling duties from the right seat, but is not qualified in the right seat fully. So at a minimum of two for mission response, ideally we try to put three. It's not as easy on the 172s due to weight and balance concerns and also the state mandated survival gear. So at a minimum of two, ideally three with the 182s, 206s, and the Gypsum air vans will accommodate those much more readily. Our Cessna 185s are limited when they go into a float configuration. That's two people for weight and balance with how their floats are configured and what it does with the CG shift. But ideally, the 185s, when they're in ski configuration, can also hold three people.
Follow up. Okay. Your mission is probably for disasters and stuff. So what would a typical mission duty consist of? Why are you going there? And what would you normally be doing when you get there? And what are you going to bring back with you in that knowledge or whatever you bring back?
Through the chair, depending on the mission itself, whether it's a search and rescue mission, for example, we have a crew that would come together and plan either a route search based on the intended or the expected route of flight. If it's an electronic search, such as an ELT is going off, PLB, or EPIRB, if it's a maritime search, looking for emergency beacons and using our equipment for that. Or if we're doing grid search or contour searches in a mountainous environment. So the pilot will, with the assistance from the crew, both the observer and the scanner, looking at what is the best approach into search areas and then how to optimize the visualization. So while the pilot's flying the aircraft, the pilot also has to be able to put the scanner in a position that they can make observations and look for clues along the ground or in the water that would lead us to find a search subject. For damage assessment, we're going to have an aerial photographer, which is another crew member position in the back, operating a high-resolution camera. And what we're trying to do is take imagery post-incident of infrastructure that may have some be in some order of disrepair, then be able to bring that images back to either the state EOC, primarily it'd be the state EOC up here, but any other agencies that are involved in that search so that they can do a damage assessment. For Coast Guard missions, when we're supporting the Arctic Shield and we're moving search and facility inspectors around, the two air crew members to optimize flight safety and do crew resource management.
Follow up.
So in a search and rescue, are you working in conjunction with the troopers? And if so, who has control of the situation?
Through the chair. For search and rescue, the Department of Public Safety has statutory authority for ground-based search and rescue. The majority of our cases are going to be aeronautical SAR, which falls under the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center. We do trooper assist through the Rescue Coordination Center, and our primary reporting would be to the RCC to be relayed to the Department of Public Safety if it's a missing individual on state-controlled land. One of the things I really enjoy about being up here, I'm not originally from Alaska, but coming up here and seeing how all the different communities, both the community level, the state level, and the federal level, come together in a partnership for search and rescue. And there's this cross flow of information, and the willingness to work together to accomplish the mission is something that gives me a great amount of pride to take part in.
I appreciate your answers. Thank you very much.
So I had a question for you, Lieutenant Colonel. Is there a You mentioned Title 10. Do you ever have the opportunity to get activated to Title 32?
To the chair, we don't fall into a Title 32 status because we're not state-owned, and that's something that I know other states have explored, but I've never heard what the answer is to that. That is something we were discussing with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to look at. What does that look like? A lot of our activation is to get to the Title 10 status. It can be a state mission. As long as there's a federal interest piece to that state mission, the approval authority for us is going to be the 11th Air Force deputy, and it's very easy for them to consider that a federal interest is a similar patrol supporting the state. So that puts us into that Title 10 status pretty quickly. And whether it's a state or many of the other federal tie-ins and nexuses that exist in within the state of Alaska that almost automatically make any request from the state eligible for a Title 10 status for similar patrol purposes.
Thank you. Please continue.
A lot of our mission roles, we talk about 90% of all inland search and rescue. This is based on the lower 48 and the 1st Air Force out of Tyndall Air Force Base. We do actively support our civilian agencies, both national and region level exercises for FEMA, the geological survey groups, and also U.S. Coast Guard. This is providing aerial imagery updates primarily. They are looking at exploring SUAS components to do GIS updates and GRS validations. The Green Flag East and West exercises, these are more notably here in Alaska, we support Red Flag Alaska, both as a target of interest or target of opportunity, but then also we support ground resources that are being added to the exercise. So it gives them a level of training that they may use in a different environment. Additionally, we have award-winning cadet program and aerospace programs and multiple grants for STEM initiatives. We did use our aerospace education program during the 2018 earthquake. A lot of the science facilities at the high schools along the Metsu Valley lost a lot of their equipment, and we were able to procure from across the nation unused STEM kits and have them sent to Alaska. So, and they were given to the municipality of the Metsu Borough and to integrate into their school so they could replace some of the STEM equipment they lost through the earthquake. Discussing the funding, the flying is going to be primarily Air Force funded. This is where Air Force allocates money to Civil Air Patrol, and then Civil Air Patrol breaks it up to the individual geographic wings. And then there's also member funded, and it's about 30,000 Air Force, 20,000 member funded. This is members, you know, funding their own education as far as like aeros, like flying, trying to add additional ratings. This includes cadets that are pursuing their primary flight rating, either in glider or powered, and they do this through scholarships. Vehicles and equipment are provided through by our national headquarters. This is through grants, also federally appropriated funding to Civil Air Patrol directly. And then the utilities maintenance are paid locally. This is what we're using the grant for the state of Alaska for a large part is the upkeep and trying to keep the lights on. This is a special note for our unit in Bethel, or sorry, not Bethel, but Fairbanks. And their heating bill is over 20 grand for a winter. So some of the mitigations we've been doing to that is going to cold storage, and that's keeping the temperature inside the hangar that just above freezing so as to protect the water infrastructure inside there. But keeping hangars at like 35, 36 degrees, make sure nothing freezes over, but it's still available when called upon. This is more about the SAR mission impact. This was calendar year 19. I have the calendar year 22 statistics from RCC with me. For calendar year 22, we had 48 missions, 93.2 ground hours, and 66.1 flight hours, 23 finds, one save. What's not accounted for in here is the radar reduction missions and cell phone forensic missions that are oftentimes a trooper assist mission coordinated through the Rescue Coordination Center. And we don't have those numbers reflected, but we could provide those at a later time if requested.
So are the calendar years, are they pretty similar every year?
pretty similar to last year. We believe we had a decrease in flight just because the weather was persistently rainy. The year prior, 2021, was about the same as 2019. 2018 was a much larger year as far as missions. That one went almost into the triple digits for us. This is some of the imagery that we provide during disasters. It's kind of grainy here. During this types of imagery, though, would be GPS correlated and able to take just the picture with the metadata on the back of the picture and upload it to a GIS database. And it would update with the GPS coordinates of where the aircraft was when that picture was taken. We did this during the 2018 earthquake, provided imagery to the state EOC of the highways that were suffering from liquefaction due to the earthquake damage. For purposes of intelligence collection, we are not an ISR organization. We do not have the when we go out and do missions, especially if they're image collection missions, it's very clear like where these photos are going, what they're being used for. And this is to support disaster relief only. It's not these photos aren't going to anywhere but agencies that are going to use them to determine, you know, relief efforts in response to disaster. This also runs into an issue with our use of SUAS assets. This with a proper use memorandum for us to use SUAS assets inside the state of Alaska requires a Title 10 status requires approval from the commander of INDOPACOM, the four-star general or admiral out of Hawaii, for us to utilize SUAS assets on a Title 10 mission in the state of Alaska. The RFF process for Title 10 is kind of convoluted. whether it's a DOD, DOD gets priority, or actually Air Force gets priority, then DOD, federal agencies, and then state and local agencies. So if it's one resource, that's going to be kind of the hierarchy is Air Force, DOD, federal, and state. If competing for the same resource, if there's no competition at all, first come, first serve. But normally a request would go through the federal partner, which in our case would be 11th Air Force. And in time of disaster, that's where the EPLOs are very, very helpful as far as coordinating that request. And then they put a tasking from 11th Air Force, goes direct to our operations center. We do also develop local agreements. We have a memorandum of understanding with the DHSEM, which is a direct conduit, allows us to respond to their request under a volunteer status as a nonprofit. And then we can request that mission, if it meets the federal interest, be turned into a Title 10 mission just for protections of our membership. For requesting CAP support inside of Alaska, if there's a SAR or life-saving mission, the Rescue Coordination Center, we are on call with the Rescue Coordination Center. They have 9 of our incident commanders' telephones. If there's a mission that they believe a CAP asset would be beneficial, they call us. If someone is requesting CAP specifically, normally we ask them to put the request to the Rescue Coordination Center what they need and let the RCC determine the asset from there. But that's a very easy way for them to activate us. Another immediate response missions, we do have MOUs with DHSEM that they can call us directly if they have a mission that comes up. And then we're also working to put another one in with the Joint Operations Center for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Are there any questions for Lieutenant Colonel? Oh, Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, can we go back to intelligence collection slide? When I read the slide and it says that you're not an intelligence organization, that you do things for non-intelligence purposes, that legal review is required, and that you do not collect, disseminate, or retain information about U.S. citizens, and the title of the slide is Intelligence Collection. I'm curious about the slide. Sorry.
Through the chair, the slides I submitted were reworded in certain areas. This is mostly dealing with our photography missions in our SUAS platforms. And it does address intelligence collections that we do not participate in that. Though we are taking photos, it is occurring in U.S. airspace, and there may be U.S. citizens inside the pictures. It's not for the purposes of intelligence retention. It's by happenstance, and the primary purpose of that is for disaster relief and humanitarian relief.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Groh.
I didn't get a chance. I was trying to work my calculator to try and get a chance to work it. There's less than 1,000 members, correct? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's less than 1,000 members. Is that correct, as I added up?
Yes.
And there are 2.6 million volunteer hours donated a year?
Through the chair, that was calculated across our national average.
Okay. Because that's a lot of hours. I was just trying to, and that suggests on the order of over 2,500 hours a year on the average per member.
Through the chair, the national membership for Civil Air Patrol is over 52,000 members throughout the U.S., Puerto Rico, and Guam. They are actively involved in COVID-19 missions still, and they are also doing, since COVID-19, they've also started doing blood bank missions, and then also the mission management and correlation of mission data that goes on daily through our SITREP reports that are going to both FEMA and then also other regional organizations, including the National Fire Center and then also Air Force, First Air Force and Tyndall Air Force Base for collection and data management.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Just want to make sure. So the 2.6 million hours, did I understand that that's for the whole country?
Correct.
Okay. Because I was having a hard time, despite the devotion of the volunteers, that it was more than 2,500 hours a year. Thanks a lot.
Representative Rosser.
Thank you. Through the chair. The slide that Representative Gray was talking about there, which had to do with intelligence. So I'm wondering your answer and the need for the slide. So have you ever done work for the CIA or the FBI? And is your mission statement so that you are not allowed to do work for the – I'm just trying to understand the need for the slide.
We need to know.
Through the chair. We do missions for organizations such as the DEA. So that would be our eradication missions. So there are federal entities when we're talking like posse comitatus status in the Title 10 entity. We also do missions with Coast Guard when they're exercising Title 5 and Title 14 measures. And we did that with a Exercise Alaska Shield in 2019.
Could you explain, through the chair, could you explain to me Title 5 and Title 14? I am not in the circle.
Through the chair, the Title 5 and Title 14 missions by federal agencies include law enforcement. So the Coast Guard has the ability to exercise law enforcement measures inside the United States as a federal entity under their Title 5 mission. I apologize if I'm getting these mixed up, but their Title 14 is also their environmental response. And so they're able to issue citations in regards to environmental measures. They can bill corporate entities that may be polluting or maybe having stuff in states of disrepair. And we're supporting entities like that engage in missions that would require a legal review to make sure that we're not going to violate posse comitatus as a Title 10 when we're operating as a Title 10 entity.
I see. Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Well, I'd like to thank Captain Woodward. Thank you for your time today. Also, Lieutenant Colonel Simmons. Thank you for coming out and presenting today. We really appreciate it. We know that the hard work that you put in answering the call of duty is something that every Alaskan thoroughly appreciates here. So thank you. That being said, we have no other business today. This concludes it, and we will be adjourning at 1:46 p.m. Thank you.